Welcome to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with your host, Tom the Digital Architect Liebel. Are you tired of spending money on marketing efforts that produce little or no results? Unable to decide whether internet marketing is right for your business? Want to take your brand to the next level but are unsure of what steps to take next? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in their pursuit of growing a profitable business and learning actionable strategies on how they can outperform brands that are older, bigger, and stronger.
Let's start this off. I usually just start recording and have it go really natural. I think it's the best way. But I do want to let the listeners know this is the first time I'm actually bringing someone back on the podcast. Yeah, it hasn't happened yet. And you've been showing up in my newsfeed a lot.
Yes, algorithms.
And it's been a while. And I've been super curious how your business has changed because I haven't seen you for a while. You haven't shown up at any of the conferences where I've been. But I mean, I would imagine it's growing. You know, it's you show up so much where it's got to be growing. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's business has, that's part of why I haven't been at a lot of conferences and haven't been traveling as much as I was like 3 years ago, as business is growing so much that it's kind of required me to focus my attention on the business and the growth rather than getting out and networking and traveling and doing some of that other stuff.
Yeah, I've been evaluating ROI too on a lot of things I'm doing. I don't know if you've read Essentialism, but
yeah,
one of the things I look at, like with the conferences, I really try to estimate how much value I will get from the conference, and if not, how much am I losing by going to the conference? You know, because like at the end of the day, all these meetings and conferences and coffee shop hangouts, like they don't get us to the goal that we want to.
Yeah, I find it's kind of one of those double-edged swords for me. I definitely spent the past like 18 months kind of down a hole of hermitude almost. And it was really good for focusing on the business and growing the business. It was kind of one of those, the business grew even though I wasn't really trying to do anything. My team just does exceptional work. So that kind of catches on. And most of the growth that we've had has been through content marketing and through word of mouth. So I'm very aware of the fact that this year, getting to focus back on networking and making connections and taking those coffee shop meetings and those Skype calls and everything else can only help to grow the business again actively. But I agree with you on the conferences. I definitely was suffering a bit of like event fatigue by the time I came into this like hermitude spot, especially because I'm not like a big group person. Speaking at events, I don't take any speaking gigs anymore unless they're like really, really hell yes type commitments, because I just get exhausted in large groups. It's just like my personality, my temperament, my health, like having to be on in such a space is just, I have to sleep for like 4 days after a conference.
Yeah, I can see
that.
But
I don't think that's the point of many of these conferences, is to exhaust their attendees.
I'm not sure. I think it depends. But yeah, I can see that, because every time we've hung out, if it was 3 or 4 people, you were full of energy. And then if we sat at a table with a lot of people, you were super quiet. I could just see, you know, you wheezing the whole time, like, I'm going to get out of here.
Yeah, I'm not a big group person. I much prefer like the quality, smaller conversations of, like you said, like 3 to 4 people. It's something like I've really been struggling with, I think, the past couple years, especially in growing the business, because it's this weird thing that happens in this online space that we're in, that when you own a business that starts like being successful and growing and that sort of thing, everyone suddenly wants you to be everywhere and to be on and to be kind of like, you know, providing all of the witty commentary and insight and doing this and doing that. And that's just not, like, I would much prefer to hang out with like three people and have just a mind-blowingly brilliant conversation than to go sit at an event that, you know, I'm, and especially lately, you know, it's all the same people and it's all the same stories. And yeah, it just, the circuit gets a little bit old after a while.
Yeah, I really see that too.
Yeah, although I am excited to get back to like a couple events that I really, really like this year, because so I'm definitely heading back to Bangkok, back to kind of the scene of the crime for DCBKK this fall. That was a big one for me, that if I'm going to start going to events again, I really want to go to that one to be able to like to be able to go and go to a conference that I actually do enjoy a large part of, and to go to a conference that has a bunch of friends that I don't get to see all that often. Like, that's the other thing that I do really like about big events like that, is you can kind of meet up with 100 people that you haven't talked to in, you know, 2 years. And somehow, because you're in that weird conference event space, like, the conversations are just ready made. And so it's like you just saw them last week.
Yeah, that is true. I do miss that too.
Let's
go into your business a little bit. So when we spoke before, I think you were just starting out. It was.
Yeah, well, it's kind of one of those. I've been freelance editing, freelance writing for like a decade and a half, and freelance editing for probably about 7 years. And so when we spoke last, I had just kind of hit the ceiling on my ability to scale as a freelancer. Shockingly, there's only so much of Alyssa and so many hours in the day. So I actually ended up finding that I was turning away clients because I just didn't have the capacity to be able to serve everyone. So I had just opened up the kind of first iteration of my business, which was more of a like productized services editing and proofreading company. And I had that for probably about 6 months tops. And from the very beginning, I wasn't really a big fan of it. Just definitely never a good idea in your business to start a business that you're like, I don't really like it, but you know, whatever. Because it commoditized something that I feel is extremely important in the way that I wanted to deliver to people. And that's, you know, really in-depth quality edits and content feedback and working with writers to like coach them to help get their pieces like the best piece that it can possibly be when they hit publish, not just like, hey, I wrote something, let's hit publish. Which I think has its time and space, and I definitely have done that myself multiple times. But you know, if given the opportunity, I would prefer to put in the time and effort on the piece. And productized services ended up just attracting a lot of people who are like, I don't care, I pay a monthly retainer, just like make sure there's no typos and hit publish.
Ouch. I see. So you didn't like the quality of the customers that came because of that.
I don't necessarily think it was a quality of the customers. I think that, again, like there's a certainly a time and a space. I think there's people who are well served by having someone who like just does proofreading, you know, just works with them on like a couple articles a month, that sort of thing. But it just wasn't necessarily like what I wanted to do. And it's, you know, one, very easy to replicate. So it's, you know, very indefensible business. Anyone who has like Grammarly or, you know, red squiggly lines on their computer can call themselves a proofreader these days. And two, it wasn't the type of work that I wanted to do. I wanted to really create an agency where I have this weird, I kind of call it an ability. It's more so just skill set, wherein I've been on both sides of the editorial process. As I said at the beginning, I've been an a professional writer for a decade and a half. Then I've been freelance editing for clients for just about a decade. So I know both what it's like to have my writing edited and what it's like to edit writing. And I saw really the value that comes from working with, just great editors and content feedback people and being able to talk out a piece and to think out my ideas sometimes a little bit more. It wasn't that the writing that I do when it's just off the cuff is bad, but it definitely just takes on this whole new level of insight and just readability when I'm able to have someone else read it and tell me like their initial feedback. So I see it through the lens of someone who exists outside my brain, because as many voices as there are up there, they don't always help me make my pieces better when they talk to each other. So I really like wanted to do that. But it's kind of one of those, I followed the crowd. And I don't necessarily regret it, because it really showed me what kind of business I don't want to have. But at the time, everyone was all, in the online space was all talking productized services and like work yourself out of things and just do this, that, and the other. So I attempted that, and definitely did not enjoy it. So about 6 months later, we switched to a more kind of agency model that does offer, individualized retainers for clients and works with them on a regular basis and kind of becomes a writing partner for a lot of these people. And that's the business I wanted to create when I started out. And so kind of when I finally figured out the right manifestation for that, it took about another year and a half for everyone else to like see my idea and get value from it. But as soon as people started seeing it, we're just at this point, I probably accept like 20% of the client proposals that we get, just because I know that it's someone that like we're going to be a really solid fit for, and that my team's going to be excited to work with because they're going to have such a great relationship.
So what is the difference when, since you've been on both sides, tell me more about that, like your lens of when someone's editing your stuff and then when you're editing someone else's. I'm super curious how you looked at those from both of those perspectives.
Yeah, I think any writer worth their grain and salt will 100% admit how much they hate editors. It's kind of a universal, I've written a piece before, of like the battle between writers and editors, because you kind of have these ingrained stereotypes on both sides. And so for writers, you feel like your voice is being stripped and this editor is just coming in and they have no idea the beauty and the aesthetic of your, wonderful written word. But the truth of the matter is them working on the editorial side, I just see so many opportunities where like, no, if you just, did this and this, if you moved these around a little bit, so it flows a little bit better, it follows like an actual narrative, an actual story, which, P.S. nonfiction does do really well when it follows some sort of story. Humans interact and talk to each other through stories. And so as an editor, when I'm able to see that, like, I just want to, reach out and gently throttle a writer and be like, no, like, I'm not telling you to not use passive voice because I'm, a bitch on high that wants to destroy your voice and tone. I'm telling you that because passive voice, throughout an entire article, one, doesn't read very well, two, doesn't make you sound very confident, and three, is the exact opposite of taking action. It's passive, and so you're not engaging your reader at all.
That's super interesting. You mentioned about getting people that are the right fit. How do you figure that out? And what is your onboarding like?
So for me, right fit is our onboarding, people apply to work with us through a proposal on our site, kind of the same way It follows a lot of, my agency follows a lot of the same structures that kind of traditional publishing and traditional literary agencies follow. So we have people fill out a proposal that tells us kind of what they're looking for. And usually, to be quite honest, I can tell probably at least 50% of the time just based on that, if they're going to be a good fit or not. If it's someone who's just, you know, again, just seems to be looking for, unless they're going for our proofreading package, which is literally just buy four posts worth of proofreading, then, you know, if they're not looking for, I really want to, you know, have the best, we work with an events, blog somewhere, and I joke all the time that, you know, yeah, sure, they do, you know, articles that are like the top six hot chocolate stands in Central Park. But like, this company wants to put out the best article that exists on the best chocolate stand, hot chocolate stands in New York. And so like, that's the kind of people that I want to work with, who have that commitment to the quality of their site and to the quality of their writing and really value that. So usually I can tell that through the proposal. Sometimes, you know, I recognize that not everyone's first impressions are always their best impressions. I definitely don't give a great first impression myself a lot of times when people meet me. So I try to give people that benefit of the doubt. And if I can kind of see some glimpses of that in the proposal writing, I jump on a call next with everyone that I'm at least vaguely interested in seeing if this will work out. And just talk to them a little bit more and find out like what they're really looking for, what they are doing currently, what they envision their future being, how important this content is going to be to them. It's kind of one of those. I don't think anything badly of people who just want to do content writing and content marketing just to like chase clicks and do conversions. I think that absolutely has a space on the internet. And I think that there's absolutely a ton of content marketing agencies and firms out there that can help people with that. It's not what my agency does. So I'm very comfortable kind of saying to people, you know, I think that what you're doing is great, but I don't think we're going to be a good fit for you. It seems like you really much more want to kind of create that like content, you know, engine that just kind of churns out content, which a lot of businesses need and a lot of businesses are doing in online marketing. We're just not going to be a good fit for you. And I can usually tell that within easily like 5 to 10 minutes of the call. And some people appreciate it when I tell them that and kind of let them know. Some people are quite affronted. I had one agency that literally, or company that had me on 3 intake calls with like different marketing people in their company and everything else. And finally I was just like, they came back and said, all right, so now if you could give us some samples and maybe do this and maybe do that. And so I just wrote back and I was like, I don't know like what game we're playing here, but this is just not like, this isn't going to be a good fit. I'm not interested in working with people who are either optimizing the hell out of their marketing so much that we need to go through this process to decide if we can work together, or whatever like games you're making your contractors play to like prove their worth to you. Like, I'm not sure what it is, but this just isn't going to work out. And it was quite amusing because they were quite frustrated with me. I ended up getting back a pretty nasty email of kind of, who do you think you are? Do you know who I am? And I was like, dude, like, I live a very happy life. I don't need to bring this into. And for me, it's a really interesting thing that's happened in the shift from freelancer to owner of an agency. When it was me as a freelancer, I think I probably took on a lot more work that wasn't necessarily like resoundingly what I wanted to do. Because you're a freelancer and you have to hustle. And right. Like, if you say no to a contract, that may mean like you don't get any more contracts coming in. For me as an agency owner, because I don't do most of the actual editing work anymore, I, you know, hire and train an extremely great group of editors and copy editors who work with my clients. And so, like, for me, I don't want to put my team through that. Like, you can treat me badly because I have no problem standing up to people and being like, hey, listen, just stop being a jerk. Okay, thanks. But I know that when you are on a team servicing a client account, you don't necessarily have that authority or feel like you have that authority. So I just don't even like to put my team into the position where they have to come to me and be like, hey, like someone is just being like really out of line, just saying really inappropriate things to me, making me feel bad about myself and the work that I'm doing. I've been on that side of like the freelancing process and I hated it. So I adamantly make sure that no one on my team has to go through that if there's anything I can do to kind of stop it.
Since we're talking about teams, can you describe your hiring and training process? I find working with writers is very difficult sometimes until they get it right. Then it's the best thing ever. But that initial, you know, it's like we're breaking each other in sort of thing.
Yeah, it's well, so I hire editors. So that helps a lot. We don't do very much content creation. Again, we'll do it for select clients. I do have clients on my roster that we do write articles for, but they're very kind of few and far between because, again, content creation clients are generally looking for like they come to us because they know our high quality, but then they're like, yeah, I'm hoping that I can literally just like give you a bunch of keyword research and that you guys can then write like 3,000 word how-to guides of brilliance that will just, you know, bring in tons of traffic to my site without any input or work for me. And I'm like, it doesn't really work that way when you contract out for that sort of thing. Like, we know nothing about your business particulars or your industry particulars. So you kind of have to be involved in that process. So I work with a lot of editors, and I do have all my editors write one article a month for Craft Your Content, because I think it's really important. I know what it's like to be on both sides of that editing desk, and I think it's really important for my team to remember that. So when they, you know, want to maybe give a comment that may be particularly touchy on someone's ideas or something else, they can give it in a way that really is speak to others the way you want to be spoken to, because they know what it's like to get those comments and that feedback because they get edited themselves. But the editors, we just basically put out job applications. So I'll put them on a few freelancing sites. I've shared them in my network a few times, and because I get a lot of friends who like want gigs, I've discovered I only have one or two times that's really worked out well, because it's just hard to contract out to friends when you're kind of existing at the level and the caliber that I expect, the standards that I put onto my agency and onto my teams, which are very high. But fortunately, the team that I have meets them with no problem. So we basically put out a job application, spend 2 weeks getting in just a slew of applications. I basically keep a list of kind of like a short list of the top candidates from the different avenues that we've advertised in. And then once that list gets up to 10, what I do is send all of those people an editing test. And so that basically looks at their ability to copy edit and proofread It looks at some different online marketing things. So we ask people for like suggestions to rewrite titles, to rewrite headlines, to rewrite different parts of a piece, and then to also give feedback on two or three excerpts. And they're excerpts from my writing. So people don't always recognize that. And sometimes they'll come in being like trying to be this brilliant editor who just, you know, lambastes the writing, which you were talking before, like what's the difference, the differences that I notice. I definitely notice when someone like tears apart one of those pieces of writing at the end, because I'm like, hey, that's my writing. I mean, again, it could always be improved, but they're some of our highest highest trafficked and highest engaged articles that I've written over the years. So I do know that, you know, that they are considered not, you know, the most greatest thing that's ever been written, but they're pretty good writing. So
Right.
So then we get that back, and myself and my administrative team. So I have a managing editor who oversees our kind of daily operations and assignments and works with clients. And I have a content producer, and she basically kind of makes sure that at the end of every project that's being, every assignment that's done, everything is ready to go and wrapped and to deliver back to a client or to publish. So the three of us will look at kind of these 10 applicants, and we actually create, because I am a very analytical person, which is kind of weird in a writer editor. I actually create an Excel sheet, and we have 10 different categories that we look at. From everything from, did they answer all of the, you know, Easter eggs. I'm not sure if your whole audience will be aware of what those are, but they're basically like weird questions or questions that you put into your job application to see if people will answer them and pay attention. Which for me, as someone who's hiring an editor, it's really important that people answer the Easter eggs, because it means that they've carefully read something and know how to give feedback on it.
You know, I've used that same thing too. So for some of the programmers and developers, I would put a lot of different info that we need, and very small, and in the middle, I would just say, do you like unicorns?
Right.
Just something like that. And some of them don't catch it. And I'm like, well, you didn't read through the whole thing. I know that. They're like, yeah, boss, I did. But I'm like, no, you would really know if you read everything.
Right. You would know that unicorns is not a standard coding terminology. At least I would hope you do. I hope that I'm hiring you because you have that level of understanding. Yeah, that's it exactly. And it's just, I mean, I think so many entrepreneurs, especially who are hiring online and don't necessarily have, like, you know, the full – being able to look at a person's full comprehensive history, being able to talk to referrals, that sort of references, that sort of thing, is just a really important way to be able to see, like, do you pay attention when it matters? Or are you just, like, filling out as many applications as you can online? Because, again, I've been a freelancer. I know that hustle. Like, I see what you're doing there. I don't think it's bad. I think you're going to get some work out of it, but you're just not going to be a good fit for us.
Well, the stories I have, Melissa, the stories I have. Have you met your team in person?
I have met a couple of them in person. We are pretty distributed. At this point, all of my editors are actually in North America. And I am generally not in North America, so it's a little bit harder to meet up. That's kind of one of my, like, in the next year or so aspirational goals, is to be able to host a kind of team retreat, that everyone can get to and finally meet in person for a weekend. And we can talk out some big picture things. But right now we're still in kind of growth and hustle mode. So
before we continue, you mentioned a couple times that you have super high quality standards. I just want to make sure that the listeners know some of the books. Maybe you can mention a few books that you worked on. so that they can just be like, oh, okay, and then we can move, continue.
I definitely can. We don't actually do very much manuscript editing anymore because, again, we weren't able to necessarily work at the quality that I liked. But we've worked on Taylor Pearson's End of Jobs. We worked on Dan Norris's 7 Day Startup. We just worked with Sherry Walling on her new book that just came out. We've done a bunch of textbooks for the Pi Image courses, Pi Image Search, which is Adrian Rosebrock's company.
Well, the only reason I asked is because they're sexy things, right? Like, it's like having a book out is something everyone wants to have. So even though you work on other stuff, I just want to make sure that people can look these up on Amazon really quick and be like, oh, okay, that's what it is, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, if you go to our site, you can actually see a ton of those authors and a lot of the clients that we work with.
And right, the site is craftyourcontent.com, by the way, just so people
yes,
know.
Yeah.
So out of your marketing, what, I guess, makes the best ROI out of anything that you do? I know you mentioned content marketing, but out of everything that you do, like, what brings the best ROI?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've been 100% content marketing. I just recently, in the past year, started playing with sharing our most recent posts, paying for ads on Facebook, just to get those to people who might be interested in them, which has definitely, I've seen a correlation of traffic and volume off of that. And I much more believe, I'm not a believer in the fact that someone with content marketing, someone can read two articles and then click a, you know, opt in and suddenly become like a $10,000 client. Like, I exist in the real world and I recognize that it doesn't work that way. Or if it does, then it's one of the unicorns that you've hidden into your programmer code. Yes. And only like the people who really get it will understand that that doesn't belong and something's very off, in a good way, like, yeah, unicorns. But for me, content marketing is, it's Rand Fishkin did a talk on this probably like 5 years ago, and it really stuck with me, of just like the idea of, as dirty as it sounds, of touching your audience and your client base. They have to read a couple articles from you and maybe hear you on a podcast, and then maybe they like follow you on a social media network because they're kind of interested in you. And then they do a couple other things that they hear, you know, they see that you edited a book for this high profile author or someone, and then they hear that you did this and you did that, and then they opt into your list and finally click through on some sort of offer that now brings them into the client's client gateway.
What is your funnel like on Facebook? Because we're kind of getting into that same thing, and the touches, right? Like multiple touches. So when someone sees your ad, how many touches until they actually get an offer? Like, what does that funnel look like?
It's the thing with touches is sometimes like there's no way to know, which is a really frustrating thing for me as an analytical marketing person. Because I can't know necessarily every podcast that they may have heard me on, or every article or guest post I've read on other sites.
Let's say the design funnel, right? So like the way you would want them to see things before, from the moment they haven't heard of you and they get the Facebook ad to going, maybe submitting a proposal. Like, how did you draw it out? Like, ideally,
we do a lot through email autoresponders. So we use Drip, and we use trigger links in Drip. So that's another thing my content producer does, because she also has that brilliant kind of production mindset. And so what we do is, once someone opts into one of our One of our email autoresponders, our most popular, is we do a free email course of like how to figure out the voice and vision for your content. So basically, like, what do you want to say and how do you want to say it? And so we have an entire email course that we give away for free that teaches people how to do just that. And we can kind of pay attention to what links they click within that course to figure out. I hesitated on doing it for a long time because it's really creepy. And I'm not a big shockingly, I'm not a big fan of being a creepy human being. But at the same time, I kind of turned myself around in that I don't want to be one of those marketing people that just is constantly assaulting my audience with like, here's this offer, here's this offer, here's that, buy for me, do this, da da da. I get those emails and I end up unsubscribing from them. Like, I can't stand that type of marketing. So because I do have to work on such a funnel process, as you're saying, you know, wherein like, I don't really necessarily know exactly what someone needs when they sign up for that, you know, what do you want to say and how do you want to say it? That could mean 37 different things that they actually need from our agency. So it's a way for me to be able to have more direct, again, like important and meaningful conversations via email with them. If I know what they're actually interested in, and I can talk to them about those things that they need rather than just assaulting them with a blanket, you know, marketing campaign. And so that's kind of the basis of our funnel is getting people onto the site to then opt into one of those email autoresponders and then kind of learning more about them. I'm also one of those old school, like online internet marketing people. I respond to every email that I get in my inbox still, which is some days amazing. Is some days I think it's the dumbest thing that I've ever promised to do for people, but I probably get between like 100 and 150 emails a day, which is still a small side of things for a lot of online marketers. But it's a hefty chunk.
Yeah, and
so I try to respond to everyone, again, cause I've been that writer who's kind of, or that entrepreneur who's out in the void, find someone that like really resonates with me. And so I drop an email, like, you know, asking advice or asking for reinforcement. And I like to provide that to people and be able to, again, have those conversations. And so our funnel ends up being just a lot of people recognize through the work that we're doing and through the conversations that I'm willing to have with people that, you know, we are committed to that high standard and that high quality. And we do want to have relationships with our clients. We want to be a partner who helps them make their writing, you know, our tagline is making your own words even better.
Yeah, so I like that.
We are one of those weird creative agencies that just really are committed to that. And so I think at the end of the day, as people get to know us through that intake funnel, the ones who are looking for that and who value that, it really resonates. And so that's been my highest ROI is just being me.
You know, when I read a lot of blog posts, it doesn't seem like they were edited by anyone. Can you give any tips for writers or maybe people with teams? How could they make that better if they are not ready yet to go with an agency?
Yeah, I think the first and most important thing is you've got to get down that what do we want to say and how do we want to say it, which is why we give that away for free on our site. I think it really is the foundation. It's actually the exact process that we use with every new client that we get. That's the first thing we have them do is fill out this voice and vision questionnaire. When you're a client of ours on retainer, we actually, you know, do a full analysis for you and write a profile and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, you can very easily just do this on your own. Get the questionnaire. It's 30 questions that asks you kind of you know, the history of your business. What do you want the future of your business to be? The history of your writing. What do you want the future of your writing to be? You know, what kind of things are important to you? What do you want your customers to walk away from every interaction thinking and feeling and that sort of thing? And once you have that foundation in place and you know, like, what the mission of your content is going to be, and P.S., like, the mission is not, I hope that people click this and buy things from me. That is a result of your content. That is not a mission for content. Once you have, like, a really solid mission and have that voice and vision for what you want your content to be, and then have someone on your team, whether it's you or someone that you've appointed who really also gets that voice and vision, to be the gatekeeper on all of the content that goes out. So they are the ones, you know, my team, the way that we work with our clients is we review all of those voice and vision profiles. We have them on hand, everything else. So when my team's editing, they're not editing just to, you know, make sure everything is grammatically sound, because grammatically sound is really shitty writing. It may work well in academic journals and, you know, the most highest of literary fiction, but it's not how the majority of people read, and especially people online. They want to read something that's personal, that reaches out to them, that connects with them on some sort of level. And so it's really important then to have this kind of overseer of your voice and vision. Look at all of the content that you're putting out to measure it against. Is this going to get that reaction that we want from readers? Is this going to be something that really resonates with people? Are we going to be able to make connections? And when that stuff starts happening, that's when you then get the result of people are clicking and becoming customers and doing that sort of thing. They don't become customers just because you put out content. They become customers because they connect with, respect, and want to be a part of whatever you're selling in that content.
Yeah, I mean, that's why a lot of the niche AdSense websites never had a single reader, right? It was all meant to get people to click on ads. Actually, the worse writing, the better.
Exactly. You know, that's so much spun content and various other things like that. I came from that world. When I first started as a freelance writer, I joke all the time that I ended up getting out of content mill writing after, you know, 8 months, even though I desperately needed the money, because I just decided I would much rather, like, sling coffee at Starbucks than ever have to write another how to fix your own piano damper pedal article ever again in my existence. And I specifically remember what the article I was assigned was. It was that impactful on me that I was just like, this just isn't quality writing. This isn't anything for anyone. This is literally just getting eyeballs on sites to click on ads.
It really was. I'm glad most of those days are way behind us, thankfully.
Very, very much so.
Since you started the company, can you tell us one of the biggest mistakes that you've made?
I make a lot.
Well, we all do, but it's just nice for people to hear, like, you know, that they're not the only ones making mistakes, because we may make mistakes all the time, but it's just good to air them out sometimes.
Yeah, I think, I think the biggest is probably what we talked about at the beginning of the show, where I kind of, to be quite honest, this is the mistake I just make again and again, because it's hard to exist in the echo chamber that is, like, entrepreneurship and online marketing without being affected by it. And so I will a lot of the time get an idea for something that I want the agency to do because I've seen that it works for other people through what, you know, they wrote a blog post on it. I heard them on a podcast talking about it. They're friends of mine that, you know, I really respect. And so whatever they worked in their particular business and business model and industry, I then decide that I should apply to my agency without maybe doing the full due diligence of like, is this actually going to be a fit for like my client base, for what I want the standards of my agency to be, for what, you know, the standards that I hold myself to. And those are the things that again and again tend to just go out in a like flaming ball of glory that I then kind of have to tail between my legs, like apologize to my team for putting them through that, apologize to customers for taking a chance without really thinking of maybe what their best interest should have been. I'm much better about that now, 3 years in. I kind of finally feel like I have a hill to die on, and that's what our agency represents and stands for. And so I have a much clearer picture. But in those first few years, you know, I'm absolutely a big fan of trial and error and like see if things are going to work for you in your agency, or in your business, I guess. Different marketing techniques, different product offerings, different content, different types of engagement, the networking we were talking about, you know, events or small meetings. Test out all those things because you won't know until you do, but definitely don't test them in a way that causes casualties. Try to keep that count down if possible. And really think of how you're doing is going to impact your client base and your team and everyone else, maybe before jumping in. I haven't really done a jump in and like, oh, let's try this. Oh, that was a terrible idea for like a year and a half, which has been nice.
So I think you'll like this question because you and our mutual friend Jody are the two people that I know that love words more than anyone else. So which books are you in love with right now? Just fiction or nonfiction? And then what books would you recommend to someone that wants to get better at writing?
It's funny. A book that I'm like tearing through right now is actually about writing. Ironically, you just are at the exact moment that I'm reading this book. And it's A Damn Fine Story by Chuck Wendig. And he is a fiction author, and he has written this book that is probably one of the most accessible books I have ever read on story and narrative. And because he is kind of I see a lot of similarities between him and early Stephen King. Like, he's very into pop culture. He's very into fantasy and horror and that sort of thing. And so he tells the book, one of the recurring themes is explaining to you how story and narrative and plots and characters work, by using the movie Die Hard as a reference.
I just seen that movie. I mean, that's a Christmas movie, so you gotta watch it.
I was gonna say, it's a Christmas movie, so everyone was watching it. I have watched Die Hard so many times, And so I love books that do that sort of thing, that kind of tell us something that's really high level and really interesting, but relate it to us in a way that is accessible and conversational. I can't stand writing. I think anytime you have to ask, is this a phrase or a term that you think people will understand? Like, if you have to ask the question, you know what the answer is, and stop doing that. I can't explain how many times I have to say that to people when they ask me, you know, is it okay to use this word? Is, you know, if you have to ask if it's okay, you kind of probably already know the answer and you're not going to like mine. So that's Damn Fine Story is one that I think is really good. For me, I have so many books that I just absolutely love. I grew up reading a lot of novels and a lot of classical literature. I was a classics major in university, so I read a ton of ancient Greek and Roman like philosophies and mythologies. Ovid's Metamorphosis is, I think, probably one of like the best things that was ever written. because again, it was trying to teach people kind of the morals and the ethics and the philosophies that the educated elite were getting. Ovid was an extremely intelligent man, but he's doing this through a way that's accessible to a massive part of Roman citizens by telling them mythologies and stories, because people learn through stories. And so when you go and you read Metamorphosis, if you read it and have an understanding of classical history, like, you can actually start making connections with, oh, he's telling this story and telling people about this because this was actually a problem in ancient Roman times. But like, as a government, you couldn't come down and say, like, don't do this thing, because, you know, it's pretty much human nature. Don't do this thing means everyone's going to go do the thing. They instead told these stories of these mythical gods and creatures and everything else, so that people learned the why. They learned why they're not supposed to stick their hand on a hot stove without having to actually stick their hand on a hot stove.
Can you imagine the wisdom, ethics, and mythical gods the current elite could write about?
I think that nowadays people, well, it's unfortunate to me that that fantasy and fiction books are kind of, they're beginning to get a resurgence, which I really like. I think in the entrepreneurial space and online and marketing and business just in general, they've gotten a really bad rep for the past couple decades, because people felt like they weren't actionable. They weren't, and that was really because they weren't telling people step by step how to replicate this thing that I did. Instead, you actually have to go through a process. Like, you change as a person when you read a piece of fiction, because it makes you think of things in a way that you probably have never thought of them before, or haven't thought of in that exact same way. And it challenges a lot of your ideas and everything else. I highly recommend, Bill Gates puts out a reading list every year. And I've like voraciously torn through so many of Bill Gates's recommendations. He loved a book a few years ago. It's still one of my favorites. It's called The Rosie Project by Graham Simsion. And it's, I may have just completely slaughtered that author's name, by the way. If he ever hears this podcast, I'm really sorry. But it's about this professor, I believe in statistics or mathematics, some sort of applied science. And he is, you know, in his 40s or late 30s, he's single and he wants to be with someone. So he creates a questionnaire and figures that he can, like, mathematically find the perfect woman by just having a lot of people do this questionnaire and then being able to tally the results, because in his mind, you know, everything is provable via statistics and data. And so he kind of figures, like, why can't I apply that to personal relationships? And then, of course, the entire book is about teaching him, like, hey, idiot, you can't apply that to personal relationships.
I was about to ask you, like, after you applied the same process, how did that work out?
I've coincidentally never applied that process to any of my relationships. I tend to avoid a lot of connections and commitments unless I think that it's really worthwhile. And I definitely, I'm like, looking back, I don't think I've ever. I do have a decision matrix that I do apply to a lot of personal things.
Yes, you told me that one. Maybe you can share that.
It's basically just a weighted pro-con list. I think a lot of people, when they're struggling with, you know, a big life decision, will do a pro-con list. You know, it's kind of what we're told, you know, it's what we're taught to do, probably through a lot of stories. Everyone can think of some movie where someone sits down and makes a pro-con list of whatever they're trying to figure out. And the thing that was really bothering me as a data person is that a pro-con list is super super unhelpful because it different pros and different cons have different weights. So, you know, if I'm looking at moving to, I'm flat sitting for a friend in Quebec City for 6 months. And that thus means that I am currently in Quebec City in the dead of winter, which is probably among the top like 30 worst decisions I think I've made in my existence to this point. It's very, very cold and very snowy and very icy outside. But for me, I'm currently in a period where I have a lot of writing and projects and different work that I have to do. I've spent the past 3 years building the business. Now I need to spend some time marketing the business and marketing, you know, getting out and talking to people, doing that kind of groundwork to make that happen. So for me, the very horrible con of Alyssa doesn't like cold is vastly outweighed by the extreme pro of, well, if you don't want to go outside and you don't want to do anything, that kind of means you're just going to sit and hang out and write a lot, which is exactly what you need to be doing right now. So I have this matrix in which I basically create a pro-con list on two different tabs in an Excel spreadsheet, give a weight of 1 through 10. So there's, you know, obviously that emotional connection of however you decide you want to weigh things. And then it basically tallies magically onto a different sheet that you're not really paying attention to until you're done the pro-con list, and actually gives a weighted value to your pros and your cons to decide not just which list is longer, but which list either has a bigger downside that you would have to mitigate against. So there's too many cons, and so this may not be a good idea, or has such potential upside that the cons are worth mitigating against.
You know, writing is one of these things that we all try to avoid, other than actual writers. I mean, maybe you guys do too, but like for me, it's something I usually avoid.
My house is never cleaner until I'm on deadline.
Is that what that is? Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you have anything, maybe any helpful tips for the avoidance of writing? Like, how do you overcome this? And
it's,
yeah.
It's, I think you'll talk to a lot of writers, and we kind of joke it off in that way that you can tell, like, we're actually crying and dying a little bit inside when we're like, oh, I don't know. You just sit at your desk and cry insanely and, like, do this, that, and the other thing. And eventually the words come out. And that's absolutely a defense mechanism of like, that is actually what we do. So we kind of joke about it 'cause it makes us feel like we don't have to be, you know, crying and dying a little bit inside all the time. As much as I hate the advice of just write, because I think that's extremely condescending and unhelpful. Like, if someone's struggling to write, then telling them to just write is like, okay, thanks. But for me, it's more get into a daily habit of writing. You worked with me. You were a very, very kind and willing beta tester in a course that we did last fall that we're actually going to be putting out in full, all its glory this quarter. Now that we've gotten all the results back and figured out the technologies and everything else with it. But it's actually a course that focuses on something called copy work, which is actually how people used to learn how to write, was just sitting down and, like, you know, you learn to write, learn how English grammar works because you basically wrote out the sentences of people who used English grammar well. And so, again, you learn by doing, you learn by reading. And so this course that we created is basically learning about different parts of writing and structure and narrative and story by copying works from great writers, both past, present, and, you know, hopefully future. People, you know, maybe not a lot of people know of, but have great things that they're creating right now. And the most important thing that that course does, in addition to teaching you, is it gets you in the habit of writing every single day without having to worry about what you're writing.
It's true.
So that was something I really that I thought, that was something I realized was just really, that's, I think, what a lot of people avoid and why they have such a hard time with writing is you have that kind of that concern and that worry, that writer's block of like, do I have anything to say? Is it going to be worthwhile? How's this all going to work? And so that course really gets you in the habit of creating that space every day so that then by the time you're done the course, well, 8 weeks later, you now have created a habit in your life where you write every single day. So then, you know, once you don't have material to write anymore, hopefully you can make the jump to starting to write your own material. And the other thing that I think is really, really important and is something I learned early on as a writer is to work with an editor or to work with someone, even if you have like, you know, if you can't afford to hire a contracted editor or hire an agency or something like that, find a friend who wants to be better about writing this year or be better about writing, you know, just in terms of their business in general, and create a partnership there that like you guys will read each other's articles and each other's works, because it's so important. Not just for the quality of what you're putting out, but it gets rid of some of that stuff that causes writer's block, that you're worried about, am I thinking this out enough? Am I saying this the right way? Is this going to resonate with people? You can just sit down and do the writing and then give it to that person, and that person's going to give you that feedback. And so basically, like, everything that you have to be nervous about and to be apprehensive of is going to be solved before you ever have to hit publish. And so it makes it, you know, I just wrote a 2017 wrap up post, and 2017 was just a very rough year for me. great professionally, like CYC did amazingly, but I think it was kind of unfortunately at the expense of Alyssa, which I highly recommend, you know, not doing if you can avoid it. As an entrepreneur, like, please, no one else expend Alyssa in your existences. But but part of what finally got me through being able to comprehensively, I think that post must have gone through 12 drafts. It took me almost a month to write it because it was such a personal post, and really, like, put me out there in a way that, like, I don't normally do. I like being personal and like sharing my stories with people, but this was a really, really kind of behind the scenes Alyssa post. And part of what made it okay for me to finally pass it off was like, I know, trust and love my editorial team. And so by the time I got something to a point that I was like, all right, this may be something I'd be willing to like share with the world, I could then pass it off to this editorial team that I work with and say like, all right, I think that this doesn't make me sound like a crazy raving hot mess, but could like you guys read that? Let me know if you think it does. And fortunately, my team is great. They edit the hell out of me and take me down to size no matter what, even though I'm the boss. So... So it's just, it's great when you are having those hangups about writing to have those people in your process that can alleviate some of those fears and help you get the words out, because, you know, even if it's not the perfect words, like you can make it the perfect words after you work with someone a little bit on it.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, was Alyssa. Where can people find you?
Best places to find me are craftyourcontent.com. It's the agency. It's also the easiest to spell. From there, if you go up to our about page, you can find me. Usually the best places to find me are on Twitter and Goodreads, actually. And both of those are at Alyssa Doucette, which is a little bit harder to spell, but it's ELISADOUCETTE.
There you go.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with Tom, the Digital Architect, Liebel. For more tips, tricks, and interviews, come visit smartbrandmarketing.com. That's smartbrandmarketing.com. And join the newsletter. It's free.